We're so glad that all of you are here with us today for this special gastroparesis awareness program featuring Dr. Kenneth Cook. This program is sponsored by the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or AGMD, which is a nonprofit organization, and we serve as an educational resource for GI motility disorders. And we function as an important information clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, nutritional communities, and provide a form of support for patients and their families suffering from GI motility disorders. My name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci, and I'm a longtime digestive motility patient, and I'm honored to be able to serve as a volunteer for AGMD. Assisting with most of the program today is Melissa Adams Van Houten. Melissa, please introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you. My name is Melissa Adams Van Houten, and I was diagnosed with gastroparesis a little over 8 years ago, in February of 2014. I currently serve as the AGMD's Public Policy and Outreach Director, and I manage several online gastroparesis patient support and advocacy groups.
Thank you, Melissa. Dr. Cook is the professor of medicine in the section of gastroenterology and hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. He has a career-long interest in understanding the pathophysiological mechanisms of nausea and gastroparesis. Dr. Cook is a principal investigator in the NIH-sponsored Gastroparesis Clinical Research Consortium and has written 143 peer-reviewed publications, 43 chapters, and 2 books, with another one soon to be published. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that today. But we are beyond grateful for your willingness to be here with us today and to answer questions and answers about gastroparesis. Hi, Dr. Cook.
Yeah, well, good morning. Thank you. Thank you very much, Angela. It's good to be here as part of Gastroparesis Awareness Month. And so, I look forward to just talking about gastroparesis this morning.
Thank you. And before I hand the program over to Melissa, I think it's a really good idea if you could describe or define what gastroparesis is.
Yes. Okay. Let's just start there because definition is sort of simple, and it is a slowing of gastric emptying in the absence of a mechanical obstruction. So that's, you know, gastroparesis, it really means weak stomach. And it has to do with that test of how the stomach empties. And, but, you know, in the definition, there are no symptoms. No symptoms are mentioned. And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, during the program, because then the symptoms that get assigned to this slowness of stomach emptying are things like, you know, filling up fast, which is early satiety. Most of us have to eat a fair volume before we're full, but a sign to gastroparesis is this filling up very quickly, half a sandwich and you're stuffed. There's a prolonged fullness. Folks are still full 6-8 hours later. There's nausea often after one eats, a feeling of discomfort, even pain, maybe vomiting, and wow, those are very non-specific symptoms. So, but they're assigned to the slow emptying, and it creates some problems in actually identifying what problem is causing those symptoms, but those symptoms are the ones assigned to a slow emptying. So anyway, so gastroparesis is sort of a diagnosis based on a test, and that is it's slow emptying, but there's no mechanical obstruction. Mechanical means something physically present, like a stricture, a tiny opening that's due to chronic ulcer disease. There could be an ulcer sitting right there in the antrum. There could be a cancer there. These are what's meant by a mechanical cause of delayed emptying of the stomach.
And there are different subtypes of gastroparesis as well, correct?
Well, that's right, because once you rule out, once with endoscopy or a CAT scan or an X-ray, you rule out those mechanical problems, then you go on to do the standard tests to diagnose delayed gastric emptying. And the standard test, the most common one done, is the 4-hour solid meal, egg beater's meal, gastric emptying study done in nuclear medicine. So there is a basically accepted test for that. And that's how the delay in emptying is actually proven. And so then, over the last many years, we've learned there are many reasons for the stomach to be delayed. Some people, for instance, have a very abnormal gastric pacemaker rhythm. The stomach empties because it has a rhythm, a normal rhythm of contractions, and that can be altered to a dysrhythmia in about 2/3 of patients with gastroparesis. But another third have a perfectly normal rhythm. And we now know that those folks often respond to pyloric therapies of different kinds. So then we know there are some patients who can't, whose stomachs don't stretch very well, and others stretch amazingly well in terms of response to ingestion of a water load. And then we have people whose pylorus is a little tight. So you see, the stomach is a very sophisticated instrument. And just because you have slow emptying doesn't mean people should stop thinking about more nuances of why or what else is the problem with the stomach. So we're talking about a fairly complicated organ that has aspects that can be out of kilter. Just saying I have gastroparesis and not going any further is like saying, well, I have chest pain, but I guess my EKG is okay. Well, you don't stop there. You keep looking for additional reasons for chest pain. So I feel the same way about these symptoms I mentioned. And I feel the same way if we have a diagnosis of gastroparesis. What can we learn further about your kind of gastroparesis? And so we are developing these subtype ideas of gastroparesis.
And that's where a lot of the research is going into, correct?
Yes, a lot of current research is around these aspects, because we know that the rate of gastric emptying does not explain all the symptoms. There's research on the rhythmicity issues. There's research on how the stomach relaxes, and a lot of interest in the pylorus. So these are aspects, that are related to delay in emptying, but actually may be more related to the symptoms that we associate with gastroparesis. So there's a lot going on with the stomach in terms of trying to understand these different parts of the stomach better.
And there's the hope that always when you're doing that type of research, I think patients, we all like to hear that, because that gives us that faith and hope that in the future things are going to progress with it. And it's perfect for gastroparesis awareness. With that, I think I'm going to turn the program over to Melissa.
All right. Okay. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Dr. Cook. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning.
Good morning. We did get quite a few questions, and we have quite a few attendees on the call, so I'm going to open it up for questions in just a second. But I'm going to put you on the spot for just a second here and ask one of my own questions. The ACG just recently updated the gastroparesis guidelines. I saw that published online just a few days ago. Can you note any key changes from the previous version, or is there anything in that update that we really need to be aware of?
Yeah, I have that right in front of me, by the way. And, you know, I would say, unfortunately, what I gathered from it was nothing particularly startlingly new, not really any nuances. What struck me was these kinds of studies look at, oh, perhaps there were 1,000 papers published on gastroparesis. And, you know, publications can be a sort of poor quality up to excellent quality. It has to do with the numbers of patients studied, how well they're characterized, statistics used. And, you know, then like 4 or 5 experts are chosen to review each of those papers and grade them. And then basically come up with questions about gastroparesis, and then, like, does the evidence support this drug or that drug or this diagnostic test or that diagnostic test? And Melissa, I was mostly impressed at how many studies or the grade of evidence, you know, based on the good studies, the grade of evidence is low, 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 very low, moderate. I mean, you know, we've been working on this problem for a couple decades at least, and there still isn't really, really a blockbuster study out there that's going to, you know, turn the ship dramatically. So it's quite incremental. Part of the problem is, what's the target? You know, if you have, so we've tried for decades to increase the rate of gastric emptying, because the definition says it's a slow stomach. So let's speed it up. And, you know, none of the drugs that speed up the stomach work that well in double-blind placebo-controlled trials. And then, so, well, what's the next target? Well, you know, sort of interest is in the pylorus. So we can talk about that later. You know, do you put Botox in the pylorus? Well, data from 25 years ago says that's not a good idea, not better than placebo. But the trials are old. They weren't subtyped. The gastroparesis wasn't subtyped. And you know, it's not been that freshened up. So this is, but on the other hand, there's more studies on the pylorus, but that's kind of new and data is accumulating. So do you see what I mean? It's a real, science moves quite slowly, actually. And so what I found interesting in the guidelines is, no, they're about the same. You start with diet. Everybody should know about the gastroparesis diet. And then there are extremely few drugs, you know, from Reglan. There really aren't any new ones that they had to say were approved. There are several under study. The good news is the pharmaceutical companies know that there's a huge need here. There's a huge need. And if anybody found a winner or a half winner, or, you know, people would really try a new drug. So there are some under investigation. So kind of a long-winded answer there. Maybe there'll be other questions about it, Melissa, but in the aggregate, I found it kind of like, you know, this area, these symptoms need a lot more investigation.
Mm-hmm. I kind of got the same impression and was also stunned by the low confidence. But I thought maybe I missed something.
No, yeah, I don't think you missed anything at all. And but there's a lot of activity in the area, and it takes time, really, because tend to be conservative. The reviewers tend to take a conservative view, and so that's the way that science tends to be, unless somebody, hits the bullseye, and we can all go off in a certain direction for a while until we learn more.
Yes. One of the things that you did mention was some new treatments or medications being investigated. That's actually one of the most common questions that we had submitted for this session, submitted in advance. People really want to know what specific medications are being investigated, being tested right now. Are they still focused, all focused on symptom control?
Yeah, those are key questions, and they are basically symptom oriented, and that's been part of the problem that I kind of mentioned before. So the problem is what part of a dysfunctional stomach are you addressing? And I think sometimes we're still stuck. Well, I know we're still stuck on the rate of gastric emptying. And so it's just really hard to start thinking about investigating drugs that might correct a rhythm problem, just like the heart. A cardiologist have many drugs of different types to correct rhythm problems of the heart. We still have one approved drug called Reglan and metoclopramide that many of you have used. It's still a good drug. It just has a black box. It can cause depression. It can cause tardive dyskinesia if used too long. A new nasal approach to delivering the drug it came out. There's different ways to get Reglan in. You just have to be super careful with it. But that being said, that's how bad this. I just happened to look this up, and Reglan was approved. Are you sitting, Miss Melissa? Are you sitting down?
I am.
Yeah. Metoclopramide was approved 43 years ago,
Good heavens.
and there really hasn't been a replacement med. That's how tough this area is. So as I mentioned, is your drug designed to help a rhythm problem? Or wait, you have a stomach that won't relax. When you put food in there, your stomach's supposed to relax. It's supposed to make room for the food. Food has a physical volume. When it comes in, the stomach is stretched a bit. In response to the stretch, the stomach must relax. Well, nobody. Well, the NIH, we have a results coming out probably in the next couple of months of a drug that's, we hope, will allow the stomach to relax a little bit for those who can't eat very much. Maybe that would help some of the fullness, early satiety. But you see, that takes somebody or some drug company focusing on stomach relaxation. We've talked about the pylorus, focus on that part of the stomach physiology. And so I think until we get smarter about what we're trying to fix, what part of the stomach is most likely causing the symptoms, and then let's work on that part rather than just this overall, let's make emptying faster and everybody will feel better. It just hasn't panned out. And so, to that matter, if I want me to, the only drug I want to talk about are two that I think are interesting. One is came out about 2 years ago called prucalopride. Some of you might know it as Motegrity. Prucalopride took about 15 years to get approved. Initially, it was to help stomach emptying, but they kind of gave up on it because, again, it may have helped the stomach empty a little, but it didn't help symptoms. But it really helped constipation. It really helped the colon move. So it got approved for constipation, but if I have somebody with some nausea, some early satiety, I might try that drug to help both the stomach and the colon. A lot of my patients have constipation, and some have pretty severe constipation plus gastroparesis. So that's kind of a neat drug, and we're using it for the stomach, as they say, off-label. There's nothing that the FDA didn't say, go ahead and use it for gastroparesis. But doctors in the know would use it for both in some patients, or just use it for the stomach. But that's one that some of you may have heard of. It is available. The other one that I think is under investigation, maybe a few more years, but it's really like domperidone. And domperidone is an old, old drug. It was over the counter, became over the counter in most countries of the world except the US. And that drug kind of works a little bit in the brain area called the area postrema. It does have some effect. It doesn't get into the brain much, but it does cross the blood-brain barrier. And it's a it is a dopamine antagonist and it has very subtle effect on the stomach's rhythm and emptying. It improves emptying, but doesn't normalize it. It's gentle on emptying, but there are studies that show it helped rhythm. And as it helped rhythm, folks' nausea got better. So, but it had some EKG problems. And so that amongst several other reasons, it never got approved in the States, but there is a company trying to make a go of it with a new improved version of that molecule that does not affect the heart. And so that's one I would mention at this point. There was another one that was gonna by a novel, a very novel ghrelin. Ghrelin is like the hunger hormone, and this drug stimulated ghrelin. They thought it would help the stomach empty better, which it did in healthy people. It was to help the stomach work harder, empty better. And after, I don't know, multiple millions of dollars, the company just dropped it because I think it actually did not help symptoms that much. And once again, simply increasing the rate of emptying was not really the right angle. So, Melissa, there may be other questions about drugs, but the two I think that probably in the next months or years people can try would be this prucalopride off-label for the stomach, and then if we get this, if this company is successful with their trials, to get approved, the drug has to be better than a placebo in a properly FDA-sanctioned study. We're very tough about getting drugs approved, as you know, in the States. Mm-hmm. Kind of a long answer.
That's a good answer, though. I'm very encouraged to hear that at least people haven't given up trying to find something to help with our symptoms. I would like to open this up to the attendees so that I'm not doing all the questioning. Is there anybody on the call who has a pressing question for Dr. Cook? Anybody at all on the call who would like to ask a question? If not, I will go to our list of questions, but I want to give you all the opportunity.
I have a question, Melissa.
Hi, Miss Debbie.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Cook. I just recently saw that the Cleveland Clinic is doing like some further research on POP, on, sustainability, how well people are doing after the procedure. Do you know if they're doing the same thing with GPALM, and why do they rule out anyone who has intestinal issues? Because I have had GPALM and I have, an ileostomy, and I think it's pretty significant for research and for, sustainability. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so this is kind of a research effort really focused on the pylorus that you mentioned. So the pylorus is a sphincter, and it is regulating the rate of emptying. So to empty of food from the stomach, I mentioned you ingest it, the stomach relaxes, then the stomach has to go into rhythmic 3 cycle per minute paced peristaltic contractions. Peristaltic contractions gently move from the sort of proximal stomach to the pylorus, and if the pylorus is closed, nothing empties. And it probably shouldn't early in the meal because there's still chunks of food, and the stomach knows it should not empty chunks. The stomach is designed for empty for milling first. It mills those chunks we swallowed into tiny, tiny bits, millimeter or two, tiny little bits. And as the meal becomes you might say homogenized, or it's put into suspension, these little particles, then a peristaltic wave comes down, and somehow the pylorus is smart enough to open a little bit and let some of those mixed nutrient suspension out. Okay, are you with me?
I am.
So
Yes.
that's normal, and that's crucial. So now you can imagine if a peristaltic wave comes down and the pylorus mistakenly is closed, or maybe it's in spasm, you may feel full, you may feel nauseated, you may feel some discomfort, and it doesn't feel good after that meal. And the patients who have a really good 3 per minute rhythm and have gastroparesis are the ones that I think are the best candidates for pyloric therapy. Because with a good rhythm, it means you have enough pacemaker cells. And we see that in about a third of patients. In two-thirds of patients, it's a bad rhythm. But those patients may also have a pyloric problem. So now you have a patient with two problems. The contractions aren't so efficient, aren't so good, and the pylorus is misbehaving. By the way, with the endoscope, everything looks normal. I'm talking about neurogastroenterology, right? We're talking now about pacemakers and coordinated contractions and a sphincter that maybe is closed, 1/2 second too soon. You don't see these things on a gastric emptying study. You don't see these things or appreciate these things on endoscopy. So these are subtleties, if you will. But it's the neurology, if you will, of the stomach. And so right now, most folks don't subtype by electrical rhythm. They just say, oh, you have gastroparesis. Oh, you have symptoms. We're interested in the pylorus. There's a device called an EndoFLIP that can measure the distensibility. It's kind of new, and so again, the literature is not real solid about normal, abnormal, but we think a pyloric distensibility less than 10 is a pylorus that doesn't distend very well, doesn't relax very well. And so at different centers, they're studying very diligently. What happens then in these patients if you would do a GPOM? So a GPOM is peroral endoscopic myotomy, which means basically through the endoscope, that sphincter muscle is cut through. And the pop is a slightly, they take a different angle, a different part of the sphincter is cut. And the hope is that with that sphincter cut, the emptying will be better. I think sometimes I use it myself. I'll put Botox in there. I'll sometimes stretch that sphincter with a balloon to try to loosen it up, relax it, and see if that helps. But you see, the overall idea is if that sphincter is reducing or is resisting flow, it's being cut, and that stomach will empty better and patients will feel better. And so, well, first of all, may I ask, what did you think of the, you had two procedures. Why did you have two procedures?
Well, initially, before I got the G-Poem, I was doing the Botox and the dilation for about 18 months. And in the meanwhile, I had lost my colon and I had ileorectal anastomosis.
I see.
But when I was in pain the whole time for 21 months, I could not get relief. And the G-Poem surgeon, he said, you're a great candidate for G-Poem, but I worry because you're not evacuating. And here you're going to be dumping into a full small intestine, and it's going to continue to get worse after G-Poem. So I went ahead and I got the G-Poem, and then I went back to my surgeon and said, I'm done with this. I'm ready for the ileostomy. And I'm telling you, I've had my ileostomy now for 2.5 years and G-Poem for 3. And I am, stomach-wise, I'm doing fabulous. I have other issues, esophageal and things, but stomach-wise, emptying, pain, I'm doing wonderful. And that's 3 years post-surgery and 2.5 years ileostomy.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Like, and by the way, did you say that they did the G-Poem, and what symptom did that help?
That helped because prior to the G-Poem with just the Botox, I still had to take nausea meds 4 times a day. I was miserable. I would alternate between the Zofran and the Compazine because I couldn't even stay on one for very long. And once I got the G-Poem, after 5 months of not being able to eat any food, just all liquids, I finally started introducing soft foods into my diet.
Okay.
And now I can eat. You know, I still stick to a GP-friendly diet, and it's still very small portions, but I'm absorbing nutrients now. I'm not malnourished.
So see, that would tell me that that pylorus, you know, you were getting some benefit from the Botox and the balloon, but not total, of course. But with the G-Poem, you know, and with some time, you know, nausea, and did the pain get better?
Oh, it went away after I got the ileostomy. I remember the first words out of my mouth when I woke up was, oh my gosh, the pain's gone.
Okay, but just a second, because you got the ileostomy because they took the colon out, right?
Well, the colon had already been out, but they had done the ileorectal anastomosis.
I see. And so where did they think the pain was coming from?
From what my colorectal surgeon said is because I couldn't evacuate due to outlet obstruction and should never have gotten the IRA.
So here, and I'm kind of, thank you for sharing this because I'm kind of, we're kind of going through this so everybody can hear how you try to, what I kind of say is divide and conquer. In other words, what part of the GI tract is causing what part of your, you know, multiple symptoms? And here we just heard, if I have it right, that yes, they tried to hook up everything again, but when you would eat, even after the GPOM, I guess it was, there was a pain, and I presume that pain was like lower in your abdomen.
Yes.
Yeah. So everybody thought it was kind of down there where the small bowel was trying to empty through the kind of complex surgery down there in the anal rectal area, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So they said, look, we can fix that by giving you an ostomy and bypassing all that business.
Yes.
And that led to pain relief.
It did. And it, and you know, in it does still take about 12 hours, sometimes 14, before the stomach, you know, what I eat becomes output, which, you know, everything's well digested by then. But so much better.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think, you know, so what we had, I think, you know, was a stomach that was very weak. We had a colon that was extremely weak. Sometimes the small bowel is weak. There's no reason why the small bowel shouldn't be weak. You've got this weakness everywhere, except the small bowel is pretty tough, you know, pretty strong. It seems to resist a lot of these diseases, whatever they are, that lead to gastroparesis or colonic inertia. And so now we have a stomach. It's interesting, like you said, you still have to eat maybe six little meals. Perhaps the relaxation part is not perfect, but you stick to your diet and there's less nausea or no nausea. There's no pain. Food is emptying the stomach and you're increasing your diet. It may be getting through the small bowel slowly, but the ostomy is working well and there's no pains. So overall,
right.
Overall, that's a very severe case that a variety of surgical techniques were needed to get to this better place where you are.
Yeah, and I really think that, you know, it might be helpful to follow patients like myself, just because maybe there's some learning curve there that could help, you know, shed some light on that the GPOM is effective. But sometimes I see in the groups all the time that, you know, people are still having such problems after having it. But then my first question is always, do your bowels empty normal?
Yeah. You know? Well, let's come back to that, because that's a big one. And it reflects my comment at the very beginning that the symptoms that are pinned on gastroparesis are fill in the blank. They are non-specific. So I've seen people get better with gastroparesis when their gallbladder comes out. I see them get better when I work on their constipation. And they say, oh, I'm better. And I was not even addressing the gastroparesis. We're addressing constipation. And in cases like yours, I'd wonder about, you know, small bowel bacterial overgrowth. Is that present and creating a separate mischief in terms of symptoms? But so I'm going to come back to two things. First, then did you get a second operation, the so-called POP?
No. I just had the GPOM and then the ileostomy, and I've been doing super.
Okay.
mean, you know, there's obviously other issues. Unfortunately, my motility starts at the esophagus and went all the way down. So.
Yeah. Well, two things then. So yes, this was a very good example of GPOM helping. And I think it's really important that people have like a one or three or four sessions with Botox or a balloon to see that that helps. You know, if that pylorus was in spasm and you got relief for a month, or you said, wow, that really helped me. And that's all you did, you see, that's a point in favor of the pylorus being having some kind of neuromuscular dysfunction. So that's a point that may take you towards a GPOM. Then you can measure the, as I mentioned, with a balloon device, you can actually measure how tight it is. You can measure the rhythm. There's lots to do about a stomach. And so, but I think in your case, the point was too, that this pain, everybody figured out was from something else. And as I mentioned, I guess my main point is, when you have constipation or you have GERD, heartburn that's not controlled, let's put it this way, if you have heartburn that's not controlled and constipation that's not been addressed aggressively, and you have gastroparesis, which one is really causing your number one symptom or your number two symptom? Because, you know, maybe it's not the gastroparesis, and you got to get the heartburn under control as best you can. And then you got to get the constipation as good as you can. And then you come back and say, how do you feel? I say, well, I feel a lot better now that my constipation's better. I'm on the proper laxative, and a lot of my bloating and discomfort and nausea are better because my colon is working. So, any case, any other questions about your particular case? And maybe that's got some other people thinking about a question.
No, I think you're, you know, like you said, it's what I have found is you have to treat your whole GI. You know, I have GERD and LPR, and, you know, it went from the top down to the bottom. And if we just look at the symptoms of nausea, like you said, we're not always gonna find the right answer the first try. It ironically, it was my colon perforating, you know, that got me diagnosed with gastroparesis. I'd been sick for years.
I see. Yeah, it's a great point. And that's why, you know, you can also go to the doc, and in your mind, you're saying, there's lots of organs in my abdomen. There's lots of organs in here. And yeah, is it my esophagus and neuromuscular problem there? Because your endoscopy is going to be normal, you know, so they're not going to find anything. So these are neuromuscular problems, you know, that lead to GERD. Is it the stomach? Is it the gallbladder? Is it the small bowel? Is it the colon? Is it the pelvic floor? Holy cow. You know, and if you don't investigate those things, you may be barking up the wrong tree. I think my other thought about GPOM is, you know, you went to a place, you know, for these, really probably best to go to a place where you hope someday that they're going to put, either they're doing active research or someday they're going to publish their first 100 GPOMs. And they follow up, and you're part of a study. That's probably the best. Not everybody can get to such a place, but yeah, sometimes folks just start doing things, and you never hear about the poor results, or you don't hear about the ones that don't work. And so in our guidelines, you know, GPOM is still sort of, you know, of interest, and there are some studies that are low quality, some are better, and they, you know, hedge a little bit on, you know, what we should do. But most studies tend to be positive, you know, at this point with GPOM, but follow-up, you know, is probably, in most studies, 6 months. It's very hard to study patients for a year, two, or three. And so, you know, as you return for follow-up, these are very important to find out how what's the durability or how long lasting is the good effect.
Thank
we
you.
We hope it's a long time.
So far, I'm doing well. 3 years and counting.
Great. Well, listen, thank you for sharing.
Is there anyone else on the call who has a question for Dr. Cook?
I do.
And what is your first name?
Paula.
Hi, Ms. Paula. Go ahead.
I was only recently diagnosed, as little as 2 months ago, and so far have been given zero information, with the exception of the diagnosis, gastroparesis, and a 79-hour transit time through my colon. I'm unable to hold water down, the insure. I went 6 months without a bowel movement before they even gave me the smart pill to test. Does the bowel not working have an effect on the gastroparesis? I mean, I don't even know what treatments are available. I'm a vet going through VA, so I'm still trying to get to Durham to even be seen by a gastro doctor. So I know nothing.
Yeah, listen, that's a super important comment, and holy cow, on Gastroparesis Awareness Month, isn't that a bad statement for the medical community, and why people like Melissa and, you know, Mary Angela and you all need to continue to, you know, talk it up, talk about awareness, and, you know, send me someplace where they do know about gastroparesis. I can't keep water down. Get me someplace ASAP, you know, or I'm talking to your manager.
Oh, I tried that. I tried the, you know, the death threats, just get attention. It's, you know, yeah. Please just someone tell me what's going on. So
yeah,
found a support group last night and learned more in 5 minutes than I'd learned this entire past year. So just,
well, so you provide us, you know, you're stepping out and asking a question, lets us almost look at the entirely different approach, perhaps, than what we just heard from Debbie, who has went through the gauntlet and has been, you know, at state-of-the-art decision making,
right?
And here you are with a new diagnosis, yet months and months of symptoms, can't even keep water down. And so, you know, I like to find out, did they test you with an egg beater's sandwich?
They tried. I threw up on the third egg and test was over, so they ended up doing the smart pill test that I kept down for the week, and that was on May 25th, so I didn't even get the results until June 13th. But it's been a year, as a matter of fact, a year 2 days ago that, I mean, I had gone 6 months without a bowel movement until I started taking the laxatives, but it had even blocked my ureter, so I was unable to even have a normal pee passing.
Yeah, well, so do you remember how many hours it took the smart pill to get out of your stomach?
I do not. The only number I remember was the 79-hour transit time from the colon.
Yeah.
But did say that I had gastroparesis also. But like I said, that doctor, I asked questions. He'd look at me like I was stupid and then just keep right on talking. So I don't even know who to ask for help.
Wow. Well, so here's so the smart pill, for those who don't know, it's actually a fairly sophisticated test because it's a capsule. It's a horse pill. It's pretty huge.
It was.
It's a huge thing. And you eat it with a granola bar. And so the capsule measures pressure and pH and temperature. And as the capsule is there with the meal, your stomach, a normal stomach, would be trying to mix it, right? It's going to try to mill the granola bar.
Right.
How do you think it's going to mill the capsule? You know, impossible. So stomach mills the granola bar, it empties, and then the last thing the stomach has to work on is that capsule. And it's a testimony to the how brilliant a stomach is, because your stomach actually lets the easy stuff out first. Starches, like a tablespoon of mashed potatoes, wouldn't be much work for a stomach, would it? And so, Paula, we go through a three-step gastroparesis diet, and you know, really, step one is just to try to keep people hydrated, and it's like Gatorade and Propel, and we just want salt and potassium and water to stay down, so you don't get dehydrated. Step two is like smoothies and soups, but not heavy cream of potato soup, just chicken noodle soup with not much chicken and not much noodle, by the way. It's very, very easy on the stomach. You know, we talked about earlier, your stomach is a mill. It has to have peristalsis, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then the third step is like starches, chicken, and fish. We'll come back to this in a moment. So there is a gastroparesis diet. I've written about it myself for a few decades, but you know, it appears in textbooks, and the word doesn't necessarily get to people like you. So there's a gastroparesis diet. It's very, you might say, no fat, no fiber, because those are, and no fresh vegetables. If your stomach's weak, can you imagine how your stomach's going to deal with a carrot and lettuce, right, cabbage? So you got to get a gummy vitamin. But here's, I think, the issue with your case. So there's a diet that we start on, and I often say, well, what's the number one symptom right now? Like, what would be your number one symptom?
The nausea. I mean, I have to keep the Zofran in me even to keep water and the Ensure down.
Yeah. So two things that I always tell people, you know what? Dr. Cook hates water. and they all go, what? I mean, everybody's drinking water. No, I say, Dr. Cook hates water, because in my patients who are losing weight, they have nausea and vomiting, water provides zero. It provides zero calories and zero salt and potassium. And so I say, please stop the water and start sipping, you know, Gatorade or your smoothie. Ensure, I say, wow, that stuff makes me sick. It's heavy. It's like milk based. And I would, you know, have people making smoothies out of, you know, soy milk or oat milk. I mean, do whatever you want, but it can be tasty, but you have to drink 2 or 3 ounces, you know, at a time, set it down, see if it stays down.
Right.
This is sort of the coaching done as I hear what people are trying to do. So your number one symptom is nausea. So where's the nausea coming from? You know, is it GERD? Is it your stomach? Or what you've really impressed me about, is everybody sitting down? Because I think you said, I haven't had a bowel movement in 6 months.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, until I started the laxatives. I've been on the laxatives, 2 Dulcolax, and 1 to 4 Miralax a day since Valentine's Day, when they finally told me what they believed it was. And that's the only way I can get anything back out of me, the Ensure included. So, I mean, I've lost 40 pounds. My skin wipes off if I touch anything. I'm bleeding. I don't know how many trips to the ER.
So, you see, with a 40-pound, well, just with that degree of constipation, of all the organs that I've mentioned today that are in the abdomen, actually, it's your colon that sounds the most disturbed. I mean, really. I mean, and to the points that we were making earlier, the colon can be so weak and so backed up that I often tell people, you know, all these organs are hooked together. I mean, they do know what the other one's doing. And think about it. If remnants of your meals have not left your colon for 3 days or 5 days or 7 days, and you're uncomfortable, maybe you're nauseated, maybe you're distended, those messages are being sent back to the stomach.
Right.
Because, the body is incredibly wise. And so if nothing's come out for a week, guess what the message is for the stomach when you try to eat? You say, I think I should be eating. I'm losing weight. I'm going to have this banana. And you may want the banana. You may think you so, but once it hits your stomach, all those, well, we haven't emptied anything for 10 days. What, this banana is a bad idea. Why don't you just get nauseated and why don't you just throw up? And then we'll be better off down here in colon land. So I think you need to really, really stay with those laxatives, really. So with the laxatives, how often do you go?
4 to 5 hours every morning, but if I don't, I literally cannot even take a drink of water without it coming back up.
Yeah, so I think that what you've shown there is yes, those laxatives have started the colon. You're emptying your colon, and you have to keep doing that. And you may need further colon workup because you may be, what we end up doing is if our two, three, or four, or five laxatives can't really help you, you become a person like, Debbie, who you're scratching your head about, is it time to have my colon out? But before because that could be the worst actor. And on the other hand, they also need to go through what can they do to help your stomach move. I had mentioned the Motegrity. I had we've talked about diet here. For nausea, nausea is such a tough symptom, but they may have to go higher doses of Zofran. They may have to go to something else for the nausea. But the real idea is, so where's the nausea coming from? Is it the bad colon? Is it the stomach? Is your gallbladder in or out?
Every test I've had, CTs, endoscopies, sonograms, MRIs, they find no masses, but the MRI 2 weeks ago said that I was still, after 6 months, so full of stool, they couldn't even see my sacrum through it.
Yeah, so they may have to even go more aggressive with the constipation thing. So anyway, but listen, that gives you hopefully some things to think about with the diet. They can try some more drugs for nausea. It sounds like they really have to keep working on your colon. And eventually decide if medical tests are or medications and diet are enough, or will you gradually work down the path that we heard from Debbie?
Okay, now with the laxatives pushing everything out of my system so quickly, are vitamins going to be able to stay if I put them in, or is everything just like coming right back out?
No, because what you're pushing out could be something that's, still been there a day or so. But the gummies should be, I'm sorry, the vitamins should be gummies. So they just melt in your mouth. They're absorbed very quickly in your bowel, in your small bowel. But
I'm
everything
writing all of
should
this
be
down.
gummy if possible. Gummy multiple vitamin, gummy vitamin D, so on.
Okay, thank you so much.
No, and you see, just to maybe put one, because I think Mary Angela would say this is a spot to mention. I have counseled people like you on how to eat when you're nauseated or have gastroparesis for many, many years. And some of you know a patient of mine, Laura Dotson,
had gastroparesis and a lot of nausea, and we went through this diet, which I spend most of my clinic visits helping people figure out how they should eat.
Right.
And eat in relationship to how weak their stomach is. What
I
is the stomach
terrified
problem?
To put and food in.
What's that?
So I just became terrified to even put food in.
Yes. No, I bet everybody on this call has heard this. And I've talked to patients for years like this, and I finally decided, forget the 140 or 50 scientific papers. People need to know what I've seen work in the practical sense. So Laura and I have written a book. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Well, I wish we were ready because it's at the publisher.
And okay, well, I am on it when it comes out.
Well, you'll like it. You'll like the title, I hope, because it's called Comforting Your Uncomfortable Stomach. Now, you may have a very uncomfortable colon, too. I mean, but anyway, Comforting Your Uncomfortable Stomach, but it's a subtitle is A Companion for Those Who Silently Suffer with Nausea. Because, you know, no drug is perfect. No operation is perfect. We even heard from Debbie, they still have to watch her diet. She's still kind of on a gastroparesis diet. Anyway, this book talks about Laura's trials and tribulations trying to get help. She's very angry and many times.
I understand.
Felt she wasn't listened to, and finally a diagnosis was made. So it's about her story. It's also, though, about the stomach, and the part I contribute is how the stomach works, some of the many things that can cause nausea that shouldn't be overlooked, some of the diagnostic tests and treatments. But the main thing is in this three-step diet, three-step approach, she has created many, many recipes. Yeah, so it's not just about Gatorade or chicken noodle soup. Anyway, and how she coped. So, that's a little plug, I guess, to say this has been awesome what you've all let us talk about, you know, publicly here. Because there's probably similar stories up and down the line. And anyway, any other comments or questions you might have for me? But we should probably. Oh, it's already noon.
Yes, we would love to keep you here forever, Dr. Cook, but it is the end of the program. And we, as always, appreciate you stopping by. I think you can see the level of need here, just a need for basic information and where to seek help and additional resources is great. And we appreciate you contributing and helping assist us with getting that information. And with that being said, I will turn the program back over to Miss Mary Angela.
Thank you, Melissa. And just very quickly about that book that we've been waiting for, and it's getting closer to the finish line. And I think Laura Dotson is on this call as well. So gratitude to both of you for making that effort to put this into a book. And I just wanted to say that I did read the first draft. It's gone through numerous drafts, but I read the first one. And I was so surprised to see how much it covers. So everything a patient would think of that would need or would want to know is in there. And I think how Laura said it is everything she wished she had when she was going through this journey at the beginning is in this book. So I think it will be a valuable book to everybody. And with that, thank you, Melissa. You did an exceptional job as usual with the questions and answers. And Dr. Cook, we have immeasurable gratitude for you in answering these questions and taking the time with us today to share your expertise and to really bring in gastroparesis awareness. And to all of you, you have my heart, you have my prayers, you are my heroes, and I keep you in my thoughts all the time, and every night I pray for you. May God bless you all. Take care, and thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.